Good afternoon. Welcome. Today is February 17th, 2015, Tuesday. It's the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And I'd like to welcome Senator Ellis, Vice Chair Senator Giesel, and Senator Stevens. And Senator Meyer is unfortunately unable to join us today. And I'm Senator Mia Costello. I also wanted to mention that our recording secretary is Carrie, and we're also receiving help from the Juno LIO. Jessica, thank you very much for your assistance today. On today's agenda, first we will be hearing an overview of the Alaska Maritime Workforce Development, the plan that has been put together, and I want to welcome Vince O'Shea, the Vice President of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. And after about a 20-minute presentation of the plan, which a member should have a copy of in front of you this afternoon, we will be hearing three bills: Senate Bill 41, sponsored by Senator Giesel, criminal record check for psychologists and psychological associates, followed by Senate Bill 33, from introduced by the governor's office, remittance of tire fees, followed by Senate Bill 34, also submitted at the request of the governor, the investment of the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. My plan today, following the overview, is to hear and pass out Senate Bill 41 unless there are concerns from committee members, and then we will hear and also take public testimony on that bill. And then we will hear Senate Bill 33 and Senate Bill 34, and then hold those two in case there are further questions from the committee members. So, with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. O'Shea. Appreciate your appearance today before the Labor and Commerce Committee, and wanted to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and then go over the Alaska Maritime Workforce Development Plan, which I've had time to look over, and I think it's a wonderful document, and I appreciate your sharing with us some high points from this plan.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, I'm Vince O'Shea, Vice President of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. That's a trade association established in 1914, where nine member companies own and operate 25 seafood processing plants in Alaska. And collectively, they buy about 70% of the seafood landed in Alaska. I live here in Juneau. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today briefly about the Workforce Development Plan. This is a collaborative effort of the University of Alaska, the industry, as well as important state agencies such as the Department of Labor, Workforce Development, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and so forth. You have copies of the plan in front of you. You also have copies of the PowerPoint. So I'd like to focus on four key points. Well, the first is that Alaska is a maritime state. There are significant demands for skilled workers across the maritime industries, and therefore important job opportunities for appropriately trained Alaskans. These opportunities exist in fish harvesting, seafood processing, maritime transportation, shipbuilding and repair, fishery science and management, as well as mariculture. So the goal of the plan was to better link the maritime employer needs with the entities and agencies responsible for workforce development. And the goal was to enable Alaskans, more Alaskans, to be able to compete for these jobs. The plan identifies critical labor needs and skills as reported by the industry, and it describes the initial steps towards improving the alignment between the potential workforce, the industry, and training providers. Increasing career awareness at the K-12, as well as high school graduates and military veterans, is an important component of the plan. And I think maybe if there's one thing I can emphasize is this is not about spending more money to do more things. It's about working smarter with the existing resources that we have for education and training. And the goal is to drive outcomes that improve maritime-related job opportunities for Alaskans while strengthening the economic competitiveness of Alaskan maritime industries. Julie Decker from the Alaska Fishery Development Foundation is behind me. She's going to join me shortly with some specific examples. And also with our group who worked on the plan is Doug Ward from leadership in Ketchikan and Matt Elwood from the Home and Marine Trades Association. So I'll leave it there, Madam Chair, to see if you have any questions.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I'm the only one on this panel that represents the fishing community, though I'd like to point out that you have many more people working in the fishing industry in your community than I have in mine. Would that be true to start with? And a second question, I'd like you to think about a little bit, events, and I appreciate you being here. I appreciate the history of the Pacific Seaboard Processors Association.
The governor, when he spoke to the combined legislature in the state of the state, talked about value added. It seems to me that's a very important issue in the fishing industry. Can you talk to us about where you see that going in the next 20, 30 years?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for that. I think maybe the number you're thinking about is the number of Alaskan limited entry permits held. The largest concentration of those is in the Anchorage area. With regard to finished processing, clearly that's the way to add value, but quite frankly, the squeeze with us is the labor cost and the cost of doing that. I think the overall trend that we're going to see is more mechanization, more automation to do that fish processing. And I think rather than look at displacing workers, I think particularly in the context of this plant, it's opportunity, because when that high-tech machinery comes into the plant, you need high-tech trained people to maintain that machinery and operate that machinery. So I think there's a bright future ahead in that area.
And follow-up questions?
Oh, just one further comment. I understand there's a major processor in Anchorage that employs a substantial number of people. Might be nice to get that on the record.
I think you're thinking of Copper River Seafoods.
Right.
Okay. They're not a member of our association, but we... So it's taken me a second to call them to mind, but they certainly share common goals and characteristics of the industry. So thank you for bringing that up.
Some 300 employees, I understand.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. O'Shea, so as a former high school teacher, I'm particularly interested in how we find young people who are interested in entering this industry, and what challenges do we face in that regard, and how can we strengthen school business partnerships in order to either train young people before they exit high school or at least expose them to opportunities that might then drive them into that industry? I mean, when you talk to young people who are in the fishing industry, usually it's because their family has a history in it, or you talk to folks and they came here in college for a job and then that's what brought them to Alaska. So I'm particularly interested in how we go about addressing that issue.
Madam Chair, there's some folks behind us that I think could give you a great example in Homer, what they're doing to reach out to the high schools. But I'd like to put a plug in for the basic life skills. They're not just needed in our industry, but they're needed throughout Alaska, and I don't think that could be overemphasized in the K-12 programs, that are young people coming out of school have the basic life skills to both go on to attend college, but also to attend to a job and to be reliable at the job and to understand what that all entails. So I think the plan clearly outlines goals that we have to increase the communication at the high school level. A lot of it's going to start at the Board of Education, which sets the priorities within the local school districts to make them aware. And I think that my colleagues behind me have frequently said that not everybody that is in high school is really going to do best going to college. There's some remarkably well-paying jobs out there that require technical education or technical training. And there's many, many young people that would really fit right into those positions. And when I talk about this, I say, if you don't believe me, just check the last time you had to call a plumber to come work on your house. So there's opportunities that way. But I think communication with educators is the first step.
Would you like to invite your guests forward? And Matt, you're welcome to come forward.
I think, Madam Chair, and with your permission, I'll leave my seat.
Thank you.
The record, I'm Matt Allward. I'm Vice President of Homer Marine Trades Association. So we were originally formed as an advertising collective to promote Homer as a place to bring your boat and bring your work, but we quickly discovered that we didn't really have a local workforce to expand our businesses with. So with regards to high school, we went and talked to the shop teachers and kind of, they have a good welding program, but what can we do to develop more of these skills? So obviously there's no money to be making more programs right now, but what we came up with for right now is we were invited. They have a focus on learning period every Friday afternoon, which is built into the school schedule. And so we've got six classes. We're in the middle of them right now. And each week we go up there with a different trade business and just go up and sit down with the kids and try to give them a real honest view of what our trade involves, why we got into it, why we stayed in it, and what kind of gets us excited about it. Entry level, pay realistic view, and where you could go as you develop skills in the trade, what we're looking for in an entry level type person, and what we expect kind of the soft skills for them to bring. So we've averaged about 15 kids for the first four classes, which we feel is pretty good. And what we're hoping to do with this is get a good sense of kind of how many kids are interested in what kind of fields, and take that info and go to the school board and try to get permission to actually develop a real program that's going to get kids some real skills.
Well, I want to commend you for that work. And what's the reaction of the students been? I mean, I'm sure they let you know, and I'm sure it's positive, but I'd like you to share that with the committee.
When you're in the middle of it, they're high school kids, so they're not asking a lot of questions, but they're sitting there and they're paying attention. and my son's in school, so he says everybody's been talking about it, and it's been real positive. And we're kind of like, we had the diesel engine guy. He actually brought a big diesel generator. We had it outside on a trailer, but all new engines are run off computers, which kids know. Mm-hmm. So we had the laptop inside the classroom with the engine running outside, and the kids were able to shut off cylinders and run diagnostic tests and stuff. And the last class was boat builders, and they came in with the 3D modeling program and were able to, and that really got the kids' attention. So we're trying to kind of play off, emphasize the more modern things they're interested in, and show them how it actually applies to trades. It's not just all hands-on anymore. You got to have a lot of other skills to be in the trades now.
And could you just briefly describe what you think those skills are?
Well, CAD type skills are certainly cross-cut across all the industries now, mm-hmm. and it's that's definitely important. And just work ethic, and to be good kids don't get in trouble, because you might limit yourself on potential job opportunities in the future if you're not thinking about your actions now. I'm trying to get that point out to them, and to let them kind of know that trade schools are a very valid option and an honorable way to go. By not going to a four-year school and going to a trade school and going into a career, you're still a very good path to take.
Well, thank you, and I'm really pleased that you've had an opportunity to share this in a public forum like this. Ms. Decker, did you want to add anything?
Sure. Julie Decker, for the record. Thank you. I'm from Wrangell, and I also work for the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation, which is a statewide industry group. Sort of an example of a local-level project or way to implement this plan. In Wrangell, we've been lucky enough to have support from the state to help us build the infrastructure for a boatyard, a marine service center. And now that we have that in place and we have some businesses working in the marine service center, we have started collaborating between our economic development committee and the businesses that are working in the Marine Service Center and the high school shop teacher. We've had some very simple, you know, meetings and discussions in the classroom first. And it's interesting when you talk with kids about these kind of opportunities, they're kind of ho-hum and looking around. But we had a fisherman there who asked them, well, do you have any idea how much I paid the diesel mechanic that worked on my boat this year? And they're like, no. And he says, well, it's $100 an hour. And, you know, you get your attention at that point. And I think so part of this is communicating that these are really good jobs. They're what I call high-dollar, blue-collar jobs. And that there's a need for them locally in our communities for kids that actually want to stay around. The challenge and one of the reasons for the plan, the overall statewide plan, is it's one thing to do things locally, but trying to scale that up to a region or even a statewide effort, you need collaboration on multiple levels, and that's difficult. It's easier said than done. So the plan is like the first step in helping make that happen. So I guess that's what I'll say. Right. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Giesel.
Actually, just a comment. You know, I like the list of soft skills that you list on page 16. Things that are often forgotten, following instructions, functioning in stressful situations, work independently, self-motivation, not things you learn in school, more things you learn in life, hopefully from parents. Thanks.
And on that topic, I know we call those skills habits of mind, and that the business community has identified that set of skills as very key to employability. So, Mr. Allward, in your situation, do you assess those skills? I know that when I taught in the Juneau School District, we actually did have an assessment related just to the, you know, being on time, being prepared, following through, submitting things.
Can we try to emphasize those? I mean, really, we're small business folks that are not educators, and we're trying, so we just try to emphasize those are the kind of people we're looking for. I mean, we've had discussions, how do you teach work ethic without going to work? And we don't know the answer to that one yet, but it certainly doesn't hurt to show them where you can go with a good work ethic, which all kind of overcompasses all those skills.
Great. And so again, thank you very much for your presentation. I did want to mention too that Doug Ward is here from the Ketchikan Shipyard, and I know you've done some amazing work with trying to get young people in Alaska in this, you know, employed in Alaska. And so if you're welcome to come to the table too if you'd like. We've got a few minutes before we wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Ward. I'm Director of Shipyard Development for Vigor, Alaska. We operate the Ketchikan and Seward Shipyard now. I wish I had some of our young people here today to tell you what their experiences have been. One was a very public experience through the National Public Radio, Kyla Del Rosario, a young woman who entered high school 4 years ago. Really didn't know where she was going. Until she took a welding class, and the welding instructor gave me a call and said, hey, there's a young gal up here that's really, really good. Can you take her down to the yard? And that was just about a year ago. So she came down to the shipyard and worked around through the various industrial processes, and all of the supervisors got a chance to spend time with her. She won all of their hearts. She went back to high school. She's working diligently on graduating. She even saved up $300 to have her graduation picture taken in the shipyard. She also got a scholarship from Southeast Conference to attend the State Chamber's Business Week in Fairbanks, and she went up for that, and I understand from the coordinator that she was there early, actively sat in the front row, led the discussions on some occasions, and stayed late, and she came back from that and is still wanting to go to work at the shipyard this spring, but is now beginning to think about college. So it's young people like that if you begin with a structured program, and we try and put some structure around when they come in so that it's not just following somebody around and job shadowing, but we actually give them a little bit of instruction on a particular process, and then they get to go out and practice it. So we call that structured on-the-job training. And so we're working, developing that whole program. Eventually for an apprentice program in shipbuilding repair, that would be a performance-based apprenticeship where you advance by testing out through the various processes, and then you can move up through the ranks. And so that's what we're doing with our school kids in Ketchikan. We've got other examples in Seward, but I'll let Sierra come up and tell you about her story. She's great.
Sounds wonderful. Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I know you work on competitive bids, and we hope you win them all as they come along. But just to give us an idea, how many employees do you have at the peak?
We've got about 150 now, 97% Ketchikan resident higher. We need to add 150 now between Ketchikan with the state ferry contract that we're building the two new state ferries and building up the Seward shipyard. So we're headed in Ketchikan. Within the next year, we'll be around 250 employees and around 50 or 60 in Seward. So I'm fairly confident that our training plan is solid. It's based on some pretty good practices, we have a huge waiting list of young people that are applying for these entry-level jobs. So kind of Devil's Area is just one story. We've got a whole handful of them, and there's more to come.
Great. Thank you. Follow-up.
Just a follow-up. And if we ever get to the point of replacing the Testamina, is that a vessel that you could make a bid on, Billy?
Yes, it is, Senator. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't say we're actively working on it, but the procurement process that these two state ferries came under is one that's innovative and might be applied to the Testamina. And certainly we're looking at that project with great interest.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I want to thank our testifiers, appreciate the presentation this morning, and if any of the members have any follow-up questions, I'm sure you know how to reach them, but if not, my office would be more than happy if there are any follow-up issues or opportunities or questions. So again, I want to say thank you for that, Mr. O'Shea, appreciate it, and if you don't get a chance, if you haven't had a chance to read through the Alaska Maritime Workforce Development Plan, it's worthy of a read, and I think it's the right direction, so I want to say thank you. And next, we will be hearing Senate Bill 41. I want to take a short at ease to give the committee, the Senator Giesel staff, a chance to come to the table. Thank you. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next, we are hearing Senate Bill 41 by Senator Giesel. This is a bill regarding criminal record check for psychologists and psychological associates. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to the Vice Chair, Senator Giesel, and also welcome your staff, Jane Conway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District M. So Senate Bill 41 provides the opportunity for the regulatory board for psychologists and psychologic associates to perform criminal background checks. They work with vulnerable populations, and this is one group of professionals that somehow have never had that provision for criminal background check. Thankfully, we've not had any known incidents here in Alaska, but we certainly want to prevent that. Criminal background check is fundamental to assuring that we have reputable folks working in the profession. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to my staff, Jane Conway, and she can elaborate a bit on the bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. I will go over a brief sectional for the bill just to line out what each section does. Section 1 of the bill imposes a duty on the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners to require applicants for licensure as psychologists to submit fingerprints and fees necessary to obtain criminal justice information and national criminal history record check. The subsection of this 0886070 authorizes the board to adopt regulations to set out how they would require applicants to renew their license. Section 2, as licensure as psychologist or associate to the list of licensed professionals for which the Department of Public Safety may process criminal history record checks. And Section 3 makes it applicable to applications for license or renewal. And then Section 4 provides for its effective date. So that are the four, those are the four sections of the bill. And we do have Al Levy with us today, and he's the chair of the Psychology Licensing Board, and is a wealth of information on this topic.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Of course, I should say I have a conflict of interest in a way because my daughter's a psychologist. But again, no criminal record that I know of.
So we haven't checked.
All you're asking is for the applicant is a fingerprint. You're not asking them to fill out a form or say I was born in Transylvania and I've never done anything wrong there either. Is there any other requirement other than a fingerprint?
Through the chair, I believe there's a formal process, an application process that then does require fingerprinting, and then those fingerprints and information goes to the Department of Public Safety for background checking.
So all we really know then is what the department finds out from a fingerprint. Thank you.
I think what we're, through the chair, I think what we're checking for is a criminal record.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any further questions? I actually have a question, and I appreciate the legislation, and I'm curious why we hadn't been doing this before, and if perhaps there was an oversight. It just seems like a natural thing, and I support the legislation, of course.
Madam Chairperson, that is like the million-dollar question. I think that was the question that we all were wondering. This industry has a vulnerable population, or can be. So why has it taken so long? And I think there's a little bit of historical perspective that Mr. Levy can divulge. And because many, many other professions do require this background check that do deal with possibly vulnerable clients.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Next, before we get into public testimony, I'd like to invite Sarah Chambers, the Deputy Director of Corporations, Professional and Business Licenses, to explain the fiscal note with this legislation. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And the fiscal note that we've prepared for this bill speaks to the cost of fingerprinting. Currently, the expense through the Department of Public Safety is $51.50 per set of fingerprints. And so we have extrapolated this amount based on the number of licensees that we anticipate to come through this program and the expanse in that program in the out years. We can't say for sure the number, however, it does seem to be a growing profession, and so we've compensated for that by looking at existing numbers and estimating the growth going forward.
Thank you. And just to clarify then, that there's really no fiscal impact to the state, that this is receipt authority where the applicants themselves will be absorbing the cost of the background check.
That's true.
And do we know what an average background check will cost?
Madam Chair, the Department of Public Safety sets that fee. It's currently $51.50, but it's subject to the regulatory fee change process.
Thank you. And I know that the division has struggled in the past with some of the license fees and things. I mean, do you see this legislation having any effect on your ability to manage the overall fee structure for the professional licenses in the state?
Madam Chair, I don't see any conflict or concern with that.
Thank you. Any other committee questions? Senator Giesel.
Yes, I wondered, Mr. Chambers, if you could specify whether this is a board that's in deficit or whether they actually have some additional funds that would certainly cover any cost for this.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I don't have that specific number in front of me, but I know that that this board has been very communicative with the division and that we continue to work really well together in making sure that their expenses are covering, or the revenues are covering their expenses.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Now I'd like to open the public testimony portion of the hearing. And with us today in Juneau, we have Al Levy. If you'd please welcome us, or welcome, you know, welcome to the committee and introduce yourself and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Alan Levy. I am the current chair of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. It's a mouthful, so we just refer to it as the Licensing Board or the Psychology Board. I'm also employed as a therapist in private practice in Anchorage. I work primarily with children and families, doing a variety of family-related work, doing some divorce, custody, and expert witness testimony, but primarily providing therapy to children and families. I can speak to some of the questions that have already gone by, so I'm not sure where I should start.
Seeing no questions from committee, that would be wonderful if you wanted to address some of the questions you've heard previously.
The million-dollar question that I heard was why do we not now have this authority? Psychology as a licensed profession was created by the legislature sometime in the 1960s. That was at a time when background checks were expensive, difficult to do, and typically reserved for military and high governmental functions requiring security clearances. And so a status quo tends to stay in place until acted on by an outside force. It's like a law of physics. I do know that for the last 8 years, the Psychology Board, of which I've been on the board for 2 years, has been trying in various ways to get the authority to do this. Initially, previous boards thought it was just a matter of regulation. We've been informed by the Department of Law that we do not have the statutory authority to enact regulations giving us this power. So that's why we're here today seeking this change to Alaska statutes that grants us the authority to do this. Background checks is simply standard practice. We'd consider it best practice as a essential part of our role in protecting the public.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
I would just show my ignorance here. I understand there is quite a licensure process for psychologists. I think that's not just on the state level. That's to become a psychologist, you have to take some other licensure exams, don't you?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it is a complex process that to become a psychologist, you have to have a bachelor's degree, master's degree, and a PhD. I won't take up the time with getting into the minutiae of it, but we scrutinize every applicant to make sure that they meet the requirements, that they graduated from an institution, an accredited institution that meets meets the criteria set out in statute and regulation. The application process includes a sort of you might call a self-check, in which they simply check boxes. Have you been convicted of a crime? That things like that. It's essentially self-disclosure. We're looking for the opportunity to double-check that. We haven't, to our knowledge, we have not experienced any problems with folks that slip through the cracks, but all it would take is one person that could do a lot of damage by virtue of having succeeded in hiding a criminal background and criminal proclivities. So we have a very extensive application and vetting process, including checking other jurisdictions for licenses. If somebody discloses they were licensed in another jurisdiction, part of the process includes checking with that state or jurisdiction to see if their license was valid, if they had any complaints or actions taken against that license. But that doesn't include the opportunity to actually look into criminal matters. It's anything done through a licensing board is pretty much an administrative, regulatory, or civil matter, not a criminal matter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
There's a couple other questions that were brought up, if I may have the opportunity to speak to those. One was about whether our board is operating in deficit. For the last several years, we've had a budget surplus of over $300,000. We have been working very closely with the Department of Commerce, particularly with Ms. Chambers, in bringing our licensing fees down to a place where we're not accumulating a deficit, but that we're mindful of the potential ups and downs. So we're in the process of lowering that surplus gradually over a period of years while preserving a cushion in the event that something unexpected comes along. So we're fiscally in good shape. Another thing to be aware of is that I did some checking on my own about other jurisdictions, and if you give me a moment, currently there are 34 states and the District of Columbia that do require criminal background checks for psychologists or people practicing psychology. 17 states do not. Alaska is among them. Also, I don't want to, this is for information, not for action, but even within Alaska, we are inconsistent in doing background checks. That currently, according to the best information I have, licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, and, of course, psychologists are not required to have a criminal background check. The legislature created a new licensed profession in the last session, behavior analysts. They are required to have criminal background checks. And that profession deals with a vulnerable population, a more limited population, but it seems to make sense that if we're going to require this of people who are doing behavior analysts, then psychology, which is the science and profession of behavior, seems we should be subject to a similar level of scrutiny. I won't presume to speak for the other boards of marriage and family therapists or clinical social workers, but professional counselors do require criminal background checks for their applicants.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I very much appreciate what you're doing for us.
Online in Anchorage, we have Dr. Philip Baker. Dr. Baker, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
So you have the floor.
Thank you very much. And I have this opportunity to speak to you folks, and I want to thank Senator Geisel for putting forth this bill. I represent the Alaska Psychological Association. I am the chairperson for legislative activities that pertain to psychology in Alaska. I am also the liaison person between the Psychology Licensing Board and the Professional Association. I sent Senator Geisel a letter this morning about our position on this, and since we represent all licensed psychologists, we are only the elected and appointed officials for the 120 or so licensed psychologists are in the state. And Mr. Levy came to see us 2 weeks ago, and it just doesn't leave us enough time to get hold of all the licensed people to make them aware of this bill, its statutes, and the wording of this bill. And so it is a requirement in our bylaws. We must do this before we endorse any sort of bill, so that we cannot endorse this bill at this time without getting contact to all of the licensed psychologists so they have a chance to get some input about it. That's one big issue for us. Our concern by the members who are our board, which includes me, that leaving these issues and trying to watch over them. It is currently, as it's currently written, it is not specific enough, and the limitations are really not clear in terms of what can be done, you know, with this information that's collected for the criminal investigations. Now, having said that, I would like to say we are 100%, that I'm speaking for the board, and not for all licensed psychologists, but the board is 100% in favor of licensing all psychologists and psychological associates. And, you know, we were licensed since 1963, and we don't know why it hasn't been done already. But Mr. Levy pointed out, you know, there's been no problems, and there are no current problems that are bringing this forth. Zoom, and so it's a perfect time to, you know, if you're going to want to put this in for new particular applicants who are applying, it's a good time also to add that to our relicensing requirement. So I could see some desire to get this in place, and we certainly, again, feel it's very important. All employers should actually do, you know, criminal background checks on people, including a psychologist. So we are very much in support of the Psychology Licensing Board and that idea behind SB 41. However, it's not, the statute is not specific in that, nor are there enough regulations to really, at least our board feels, to really make us comfortable with going ahead with it at this time. There's no even, not even any date as to when all this might occur. And so we are not prepared, the Alaska Psychological Association is not prepared to back this bill at this time. We would be delighted. I will work, and my colleagues, Robert Ryan and others, will work with anybody on the licensing board and or whomever else you want to fill out this bill, both in statute and regulation, so it will be more comfortable to everybody that has to submit to it. So that's basically what I have to say.
Thank you very much, Dr. Baker. Any questions from committee members? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually don't have a question. I more wanted to help Dr. Baker understand what statute is. It provides the authority for the board then to go forward in writing regulation. So this is the
first. Senator, it's just not clearly written enough, doesn't fill out enough to make us comfortable, at least the heads of our professional association, without, you know, further delineation. And then,
Dr. Baker,
yeah.
Thank you. And if could I finish what I was going to say? Thank you.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. So what I was going to explain to you is that there are very specific laws about how the background checks are used. First of all, they go not only from our Department of Public Safety, but it goes beyond that to the FBI. And the FBI requires that this background check now will be held only by the Psychology Regulatory Board. It cannot be used by anyone else. They cannot share it with anyone else. The documents themselves must be kept in a locked facility. And so it is specific. Its use will be specific for licensing, and all of those details will be fleshed out later. They will not be fleshed out in statute. So it would be good for you to check a bit further with Mr. Dr. Levy, and he can kind of fill you in on how this process works. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Giesel, and certainly, you know, we oftentimes in the legislature don't find ourselves running too fast with something, and so I find it interesting that, the association actually hasn't had a chance to meet. However, I did want to mention for the public and the members of the committee, as you know, this bill will be going on to judiciary, and certainly the Senate Judiciary Committee will be able to look at all of those issues too, and in fact, the regulations do follow the law, and so I appreciate that explanation, Senator Giesel. Any questions from committee members for Dr. Baker? Nope. Thank you very much.
May I make a point of clarification?
Dr. Webby, go ahead and approach the table, if you mind, and introduce yourself, please, for the committee.
That's the point of clarification I need to make, is that I'm not a doctor.
Okay.
That I'm licensed to practice psychology as a psychological associate, which essentially means I can do anything that a psychologist can do except call myself doctor. So I should have made that clear in my original testimony, but I feel it's important to get the record straight about that. I don't want to misrepresent my qualifications here.
Thank you, Mr. Levy, and I appreciate that, certainly. With that, is there anyone else online who would like to participate in the public comment section? Okay. Seeing none, public comment is now closed. Are there any final comments from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Well, it's interesting to hear Dr. Baker's comments, but I'm really comfortable with where we are moving this through out of this committee and on to judiciary and onto the floor and through the House. I don't think we're rushing it. I think this is the proper way to do it.
Seeing no further questions, Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate Bill 41, version 29LS0170/H, be moved out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, so moved. And we will take a brief at ease while the committee members sign the document. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 33, Remittance of Tire Fees. This one has been introduced at the request of the governor. And we also have in the audience Anna Kim, the Chief of Operations for the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue, and if you'd like to join us to explain the governor's legislation. And welcome, Mr. Burnett, too. You can both introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. For the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And if I could, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to thank you for hearing this bill on behalf of the commissioner. Commissioner Hoffbeck, unfortunately, is in another committee right now, talking about AKLNG financing. And so he's unable to be here, but I wanted to just express our gratitude to the committee on behalf of Commissioner, and then I'll turn it over to Anna Kim, and also the same goes for Senate Bill 34, which comes up next.
Welcome.
I'm Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Anna Kim, Chief of Revenue Operations for Department of Revenue Tax Division. I also have online Brandon Spanos, our Deputy Director. Senate Bill 33, Fee for Tires, Tire Remittance. We brought this forward mainly as an administrative change. Currently, the tire fee return and payments are due 30 days following the last day of the calendar quarter. And for three of those quarters, the return and payments are due prior to the last day of the month because some of the ending dates have 31 days. So what we'd like to propose is that the filing confusion for our taxpayers be remedied by aligning the due date of the return and payment with other tax types so it would read to the end of the month. I didn't know if you wanted me to walk through sections of the bill or...
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
Thanks.
So in section one of the bill, this changes the return and payment due dates from 30 days following the last day of the calendar quarter to the last day of the calendar month. So currently that means due dates that are July 30, October 30, January 30 would change to July 31, October 31, and January 31. Section 2 aligns the payment date used to determine timely pay credit with the new due dates in Section 1. Section 3 applies the due date changes to the first calendar quarter after the effective date of this Act. And the last section, the Act takes effect immediately. The fiscal note accompanying the bill is a zero fiscal note, and I'll entertain any questions you guys might have about the bill.
Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Is there any opposition to this?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, not that I know of. I think our taxpayers would appreciate us being more consistent.
Wonderful. Mr. Spanhouse, would you like to provide any comments on the bill?
Yes, in answer to that last question through the chair, there's no opposition that we know of. It's just difficult to explain that in instructions. Each of our forms for our quarterly filers as well as our monthly filers, we explain that the return is due by the last day of the month. Mm-hmm. And when it's due the 30th day of the month, you have to add some extra language there, and it doesn't always come out clearly in writing, so the taxpayer generally is confused, and we get a lot of late filers. They have up to a $900 credit that they lose if they file one day late. Mm-hmm. The penalty isn't quite that much. It's just 5% for each 30-day period, but they also lose the credit, and that makes a lot of taxpayers quite upset, and we have to explain, sorry, that's the way the statute's written.
Okay.
It would be easier to simply say it's the last day of the month. There's no ambiguity there.
Thank you for that explanation. Certainly, we're all striving to make government more friendly and reasonable. So, I appreciate the legislation. Any questions from committee members, Mr. Spanhouse? Seeing none. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online that would like to participate in a public comment on this legislation? Okay. Seeing none, public comment for this bill, Senate Bill 33, is now closed. And with that, my intent was just to hold this bill until the next hearing, and then also this afternoon to take up Senate Bill 34. So that's the intention. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to welcome Pam Leary, the Director of Treasury, to explain Senate Bill 34, which is investment of the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund, and also Gary Bader, the Chief Investment Officer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Pam Leary, the Director of the Treasury, and with me is...
Gary Bader, Chief Investment Officer, Department of Revenue.
And I actually submitted a slide deck, but I don't think we have a need to go through it. You probably have it in your folders. I thought what we would do is talk a little bit about the fund history, then talk about the bill, and then Gary will talk a little bit about the investment side of the equation. The fund purpose is to fund the Power Cost Equalization and Rural Electric Capitalization Fund, as well as reimburse the costs associated with managing the fund. 7% of the monthly average market value of the fund for the previous three fiscal years is what can be appropriated. And there's an annual appropriation that basically is used by the Power Cost Equalization and Rural Electric Capitalization Fund to fund the cost of energy in areas that are experiencing high energy costs. The fund was first invested in 2000. It was created, it was established with $100 million from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. It was an appropriation. And then it received an additional $89.6 million in 2002 from proceeds of the sale of the Four Dam Hydroelectric Project. There were two additional appropriations, one in 2007 and again in 2012. The first one for $182.7 million, and then another one for $400 million. And as of January 31st, the fund stands with a balance of $950.7 million. In terms of the legislation, it has a principal reason. It is removing the stated nominal return target of at least 7% from the existing statute, and it allows the Commissioner of Revenue to invest the fund in a manner that the objectives of the fund can be met. And why is this necessary? It would allow the Commissioner of Revenue, rather than targeting 7% if it's deemed a risky target, to invest it perhaps a lower rate that will still meet the financial needs of the program. There is a zero fiscal note associated with this bill. It will not require additional funds to continue the work managing the fund that the Treasury does. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bader to discuss some of the investment side.
Thank you, Ms. Leary. Madam Chair, the goal of every investment program is to achieve the highest rate of return with the lowest amount of risk possible. Under the current law, the direction to the Commissioner of Revenue is to achieve a specific rate of return without regard to the risk undertaken to accomplish that objective. In your packet, you have a page that is entitled 2015 Capital Market Expectations. This is provided by Callan Associates to the Alaska Retirement Management Board and is their best estimate of what might be possible to not possible to achieve, but likely to be achieved over the next 10 years. Their capital market assumptions are very similar to those issued by J.P. Morgan and many of the large investment banks. On this slide, I call your attention, there are essentially three sections. The top section shows the return of equities, what we know as stocks, generally. Different types of stocks, large cap, small cap, emerging market, and so on. And I call your attention to the fact that you have something there called the one-year arithmetic return, okay? The arithmetic return simply means what might you expect the average or the mean over a course of time? Over on the right-hand side of the, about in the middle of the page, you see projected risk is standard deviation. The standard deviation means that two-thirds of the time you could expect the return of that particular asset to be plus or minus the standard deviation from the arithmetic return. So looking at bond domestic equity, that would, you would expect to earn 9% plus or minus 19% over the number of years. Now I call your attention to the next column of returns called the 10-year geometric return. Why is a 10-year geometric return lower than the average return? And the answer is that it lies in that standard deviation number. For example, let's just say that the expected return was zero and it had a standard deviation of 50%. So if you started with $100 and the first year to earn 50% on that, you'd have $150. But let's say the next year you lost 50% of that, you would have $75. Your return is less than the average of the 2 years return. So risk is very important in terms of establishing a investment program. Now we have, in this instance, the desired return is 7%. And I call your attention to the 10-year geometric returns on equities. They're all just slightly above 7%. In order to achieve the 7%, the Commissioner of Revenue would have to adopt an asset allocation that is almost entirely stock. And when you have standard deviations that mean it could drop 20 to 30% in 1 year, that's a risky program. We have had experience in the stock market the past 6 years that is wonderful. Every year up for the last 6 years. I don't think it's ever happened that we've had 7 years up. We'll keep our fingers crossed and hope for that. But that's not a way to run an investment program. I think many commissioners would like to take some of the risk off the table, given the situation that we're in with equity markets having done so well. So the passage of this bill would allow the commissioner to attempt to meet the goals of the program while not being locked into trying to get a 7% nominal return. And that's why he supports the bill. Thank you.
Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
I just wanted to ask you, have we achieved the 7% in recent past history?
Yes, we have. Do you have that summed, Pam? We've done very well with this fund, quite frankly. But, and I can get you the number, but it, well, we've achieved it, yes.
Senator Stevens?
Well, no, I just, I don't think it's the right approach to take, and of course it doesn't change your intention of getting the highest return you can.
Right.
Yeah. Very good, thank you.
My question has to do with the reason behind the legislation. Was this a recommendation that came out of a certain group, or is it simply the administration's review of the fund and how to manage it?
This legislation has been proposed before. It didn't move through the process, but this has been the feeling not only of this commissioner, but commissioners that preceded him.
All right. Thank you for that. Seeing no other questions from the committee members, I want to thank you, Ms. Leary and Mr. Bader, for appearing before the committee. I will not be holding public testimony on this bill. We will hear it on Thursday and give committee members a chance to review it and additional time if they have any questions that they want to bring for the next hearing. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
On Thursday, in addition to bills previously heard, including Senate Bill 33 and Senate Bill 34, we will be hearing Senate Bill 5, the loss of income and valuing property for restitution. And we will also be hearing and holding Senate Bill 39, repealing the film tax credit. So are there any final comments by committee members? Seeing none, I want to thank everyone today for testifying. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.